A very good evening, everyone. Thank you for joining. A little rain never deterred determined people. The topic that we are focused on in this third session is meat, dairy, and fish, all in one class, but not all in one. What you may find in the laws of basar b'chalav, separation of milk and meat, is that it seems like we are overly stringent. The original pasuk in the Torah says, "Lo sevashel gidi b'chalev imo," you should not cook a kid, the goat, in its mother's milk. And that's the biblical prohibition, cooking the two together. But we go ahead and we have different tablecloths. Tablecloth, where you serve the food, is not really where it's at high heat. I mean, what exactly are we worried about? We have different dish racks, etc. Now, it could be that there's source in terms of what exactly we're nervous of, that sometimes things are very hot, whatever. But I've often felt that Klal Yisrael wants to make sure that every Jew, no matter how far they drift, will still keep this mitzvah. And it's ingrained. And it's considered, we don't like to say one mitzvah is more important than the other, but it's considered one of the fundamental heartstrings of the Jewish people, separating milk and meat. I don't want to spend too much time on tamei ha-mitzvahs, the reasons for mitzvahs, or appreciating what the insight is, but it does seem worthy to comment that some Mefarshim understand this prohibition as being an expression of limiting our mastery on creation. The mitzvah is expressed in a very poetic way, which is a bit unusual. You shouldn't cook the kid in its mother's milk. Now, la halacha, we know it has nothing to do with whether it's the mother of that child or not. But there's a concept here not to go ahead and use the milk which is intended to nurture the child and go ahead, not just kill the child, not just take the milk, but cook the kid in the mother's milk. And it's an expression of withholding our mastery on creation and telling HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you're the one in charge. We have limitations as to how much we're going to benefit from this world. And if the way we express it is by not having a cheeseburger, so be it. But it's an expression of we have a limitation. With that in mind, I'd like to express the tefillah that our learning tonight and Mitzvah Shem, whatever good comes out, should be a zuchus for Klal Yisrael and a zuchus on a personal level for the different things that we've been davening for protection, for refuah shleima, for shiduchim. There's a lot on the Jewish plate right now. There's a fascinating pasuk in Shir HaShirim that is not quoted enough. Most people quote the pasuk, Ani l'dodi v'dodi li, which is very heartwarming. I am to my beloved is to me. But there's a different, similar pasuk, which has a very different meaning. Pasuk says, Dodi li va'ani lo. My beloved looks to me, and I look to him. And the Mefarshim say it means that when Hashem needs a mitzvah done in the world, he looks to us to do it. He knows he can count on us. And when we need something done, we turn to Him, because we know there's no other place to turn. Dodi li va'ani lo. And when we talk, if basa b'cholov, at least one insight is, we're not totally in charge, and we recognize Hashem is in charge, then let these mitzvahs and halachas be a zuchus for Klal Yisrael to ask Hashem to indeed be in charge in a benevolent way.
Amen.
I'd like to go through some very practical aspects of the kitchen. Mrs. Sadwin offered that she'd bring in props of anything that I want. So tonight we're going to need the stovetop, the oven. Okay, maybe we'll
do a field trip.
We could do a field trip. Maybe we could just have the power of imagery and make it work.
We can make a hole in the wall.
Are you offering your sons to do it?
You asked. They'll probably fix it.
They will do it with a one-way glass. I'm not sure which direction. So I'd like to start with ovens, because I think it's a great example of how people can have different shitos, different opinions. People can get confused because everybody's got a different angle. But ultimately, they're all well-grounded. And ultimately, we have to give a ruling as to how people should conduct themselves in the shul kitchen and how one should conduct themselves in their own kitchen. We're definitely in your own kitchen. If your custom is a little bit more lenient, no problem. It's well-grounded. But in the shul, as is typical, we want to make sure that we're accommodating general population. So the concept of an oven is that when you cook something open, there are two interpretations of what happens in the oven. One interpretation, you're cooking open tray of meatballs, you're grilling hamburgers. The steam, the zeya, the spritzing, the entire experience is hitting the walls of the oven and turning them into, if it was a fleishik dish, into a fleishik pot. And if it was a milchik dish, it's turning the walls into a milchik pot. And then, who in his right mind would go ahead and put the opposite type into the same oven? Open. Doesn't make any sense. Would you put meatballs into a milchik pot, lasagna into a fleishik pot? Doesn't make any sense. And according to that stricter view, we're going to require some level of kashering of the oven in order to use it for the other type. That is compounded by a different halacha, which is that we don't normally kasher from milchik to fleishik, fleishik to milchik, because we're worried you're going to lose track. The one exception is for Pesach. You kasher for Pesach, and once it's kashered, you can use it for whatever you want. We don't restrict you, it's already kashered. But to purposely kasher one to the other, back and forth, you're not allowed to do it, you'll lose track. So, those who are strict regarding ovens, but are looking to give a reasonable solution to people, so it depends who you are. You may consider a reasonable solution using a toaster oven for one type that you use less of, and using the regular oven for the other type. But for the vast majority of people who want to use the oven for both, if you take the stricter view, so then they require a level of kashering, and the strict view comes in varying models. One view is wait 24 hours before kashering, so that it's an eina ben yomo, it's not used within 24 hours, which makes it more lenient. and then you kasher it. You could kasher it anywhere from turning it on to its highest setting for 40 minutes, for an hour, for 90 minutes, for 2 hours, self-clean it. Self-clean it for 2 hours, self-clean it for 4 hours, blowtorch it as long as you don't get hurt. There are a lot of varieties of what you could do. The more lenient approach is that the walls of the oven are like a stove grate. We'll see later source material on a stove grate. You're allowed to use a stove grate going from milchik to fleishik back and forth without a problem because it kashers itself. There's no milk, there's no meat dripping on the grate normally. If perchance it did drip on it, so fine, so kasher it. Let it burn itself out before you use it again. But for the most part, the item is not becoming milchik, not becoming fleishik. It's merely touching a pot that is milchik, or touching a pot that's fleishik. It itself never changed. And as soon as you remove the milchik fleishik from the oven is neutral. Nothing has happened to the oven. If there was some steam that hit, it instantly burnt. And the more lenient approach says, you can do milchik fleishik, same oven, open as long as it's not at the same time. As long as one's out, right? When out is in is out. And then you're fine. For somebody who has a custom or a psak, a ruling, that's the more lenient approach, it's 1,000,000,000% orthodox, and you can continue doing so. There's no problem. If you want to know heavyweights on this machlokas, it seems to be a machlokas between Rabbi Aaron Cutler, Lakewood, and Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, Posek Hador. But it seems that Rabbi Aaron Lakewood was actually the more lenient in understanding ovens. Lakewood itself has adopted, for the most part, the more strict approach, which is a little odd, because, you know, their Rosh Yeshiva and their mentor took a different understanding of an oven. To me, it's not really about kulis and chumris, it's how you understand an oven. But if a person has the lenient approach, it's perfectly acceptable. However, it is not acceptable to impose your approach on somebody who's a diehard of the stricter approach. And therefore, when we cook for somebody who uses the stricter approach, we would purposely burn out our oven for an hour, let's say, just so that food that's going out of our own home to somebody who might be makbid on this and might actually consider it a serious kashrus concern, we accommodate that. And we send them food that's appropriate for their standard. Yeah?
Question. So we're going to have 2 ovens. So my recollection was, we were told, was that you wouldn't have both uncovered. And like, in other words, if you want to have fleishiks uncovered in the oven, then if you put milchiks in, they have to be covered, or vice versa. That you couldn't have both uncovered. Which sounds sort of like in between the two you said, or maybe I'm misremembering. But
no, so that's a variation of the stricter approach.
Well, stricter approach says you have to caution.
You're assuming that the oven has a status,
right,
of whatever you keep open,
right,
in the oven.
Right.
And now you're putting into the oven, provided that it's clean, right?
Right.
You can't,
right,
have wet residue,
sure,
sitting around.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But provided that it's clean, and it's just a question of whether it's considered a fleishik pot or a milchik pot.
Right.
So you're covered.
Right.
Which, covered,
so
with
tin
foil,
kasher.
You don't have to kasher.
Right. Okay.
Because what you're doing is you're putting it in,
right,
covered So it's covered. It's not connected to the steam is not connecting it to the outer pot. Now, if all things were equal in a shul setting, we definitely would have a fleishik set of ovens and a milchik set of ovens, and we would be totally separate. The reason, as we'll see, is number one, because you want to take the approach that will accommodate your entire tzibur, your entire congregation. So you go with whatever's reasonably the higher standard. Also, when you're dealing with a communal setting, you have to be careful, because it's always questionable who's going to be ultimately responsible. So in your own kitchen, you'll make sure that your oven is clean. And you know if it's clean. If it starts smoking, you don't blame it on someone else. You go check why it's smoking. I mean, you're in touch with it. The fear on a communal level always is who's in charge. Now, part of the structure of our shul and other responsible shuls is that you put someone in charge. Whoever's the mashgiach is put in charge, and that person is looking with hawk eyes, okay, what's going on here? But nevertheless, you want to structure things so that things can't go wrong. So ideally, you would have milchik side, fleishik side, everything color-coded, and we're certainly working in that direction to the extent that we can. Sometimes, happens everywhere, you're running an event that simply needs more oven power than you have. And you don't have enough milchiks or you don't have enough fleishiks. And one of the solutions is to use the ovens that normally are used on the other bay and to use them to support your event. Doing so, which is why we're discussing it, has to be done with caution. Number one, you want to make sure that the oven is clean, that the last person who catered an event or whatever wasn't sloppy about it and left things hanging around, because it's going to be very uncomfortable to later realize that there was chicken on the bottom of the oven that was steaming up and burning and whatever, or pizza sauce that was on the bottom together with cheese. It's just like, you don't want to go there. So to check the oven. Some people will purposely turn on the oven in a quasi-koshering effort. And the way I see it, it's not so much koshering it intensely that the walls truly got that hot. It's more of a, like, if there was any spillage on the racks, it would start smoking and I'd know about it. So you preheat the oven on the highest setting, you let it go a little, and you feel that if you haven't truly kashered, but at least you're on good turf. Very often you're running a Matzei Shabbos event, and that's simply not practical. From the time Shabbos is over until the time that you have to start warming the food, you just don't have time to do any of those types of extras. So what's commonly done is you eyeball the oven. You know what you're dealing with. You know that it's clean. And hopefully it is. And then you double wrap whatever's going into it. Double wrap with tinfoil. I'm mentioning this meticulously so that we know that when we double wrap, we're already reaching out a little bit out of our comfort zone. So that we're going to make sure to double wrap properly. We're going to make sure that the oven is indeed clean. And then, what you're doing is indeed going to end up highest standard, available to everybody, but we should realize that it's not the perfect, picture-perfect thing, but it's perfectly acceptable as long as you know that.
Yeah.
I always get confused when you say double wrap. So you have aluminum tin. The original item is an aluminum tin covered with a piece of foil. Then do we need two more layers or just one more layer of tin?
If it's already covered, really you need one more layer.
Just one more layer?
Just on the top or on the bottom?
The whole thing, right?
You should do the entire thing. You should double wrap it, totally. You don't want any seams. If the first layer has already been opened and tampered with and whatever, it's not perfect, so then do entirely two layers. But that's the truth. If it's coming in perfectly sealed, the way a caterer, let's say, sends it in, folded over and everything good, it's just going to need one layer, one good layer over that. Question? Another item before we get to the handout. We normally wait between meat and milk. We wait 6 hours. There are a lot of different customs about that. And it's, again, it's a perfect example of it's important to understand that customs are based on legitimate rulings, and a person should be upholding whatever their own custom is. There are those who maintain that it's not a full 6 hours, but it's into the sixth hour, based on the Rishonim, kishesh sha'os, like 6 hours, that it wasn't a perfect science. In the Gemara, it actually talks about waiting the amount of time from one meal to the next. And then it developed into a firm number as time went on. But the German custom, because of the way they ate meals, was a 3-hour wait. And everybody jokes when they marry into a German family or out of a German family, the ramifications of chocolate, milk chocolate that is, that's fine. But they're different customs. The simple understanding is you got to wait a full 6 hours. But there are people that wait majority of the 6 hours, meaning 5.5 plus, etc. It's important to know this besides our own personal customs. It's important to know all this because sometimes you're in a situation, not particularly the shul setting, but life, where you have a patient, whether it's, I had it with my grandfather, when you have somebody who needs to have a dairy drink and they need to have it after the fleishik meal. Doctor says if you drink, ensure an energy drink before the meal, it's going to kill your appetite. So I need you to drink it after the meal. And the meal in the nursing home is fleishik. What's he supposed to do? He waits 6 hours. It's not happening. And at that point, we rely on the concept that the health issue is going to outweigh the custom, and we're going to whittle down the amount of time that has to be waited, even as low as waiting 1 hour as opposed to waiting 6. And if people aren't aware of such a halacha, I'm not expecting people to paskin it, but at least you know to ask the shayla, that it's not as hard and fast as it is when you're just maintaining a custom under normal circumstances. And in his case, he was eating fleishik for lunch, he waited 1 hour, and drank the energy drink. Let's take a look. Page 5, stovetop grates. This is a quote from the Mishnah Berurah in Hilchos Pesach. Where chatzuva tzorich libun. The Shulchan Aruch paskins that a trivet upon which you do your cooking, it needs to be kashered for Pesach.
Says the Mishnah Berurah, in case you didn't know what a chatzuva was. Kli sheyesh la gimel raglayim, it has three legs, u'ma'amidim alea kedera o'machavas batanur al ha'ur kol hashana. And upon it you put your pot with the fire all year. Imrotze lishtamish baba Pesach, if you want to use it for Pesach. Tzorech lelavna ba'or, you got to kasher it, right? What do we do to such a grate in order to use it for Pesach? Put in the self-clean oven. What are the other solutions?
Blowtorch.
Yikes. There's a special training course for that. Some people simply burn it out in place. Some people put it into a regular oven at the highest setting. Doesn't have to necessarily be self-clean. But we're fulfilling exactly what they want of us, that we should kasher it with fire. Right? 45 minutes on the highest setting, whatever it is. Why does it have to be kashered? Lifi shalifa'omim nishbach alea isa, because sometimes a doughy substance falls upon it, your oatmeal overflows. V'nivla botam chametz ayidei ha'ar, and now it has become chametz dik. Says the Mishnah Berurah, v'zeu rak lechatchila mishum chumra de chametz. This is a stringency of chametz. This is not strict halacha. This is an important principle. When two pots touch each other, milchik pot, fleshik pot, touching each other, they're both hot, but there's no liquid between them, no moisture. Ein yotzes habliya mizu lezu, there is no transfer of taste. So we're going to see many cases that we try to avoid having milchik and fleshik cooking on the same stove top at the same time if they're open, unless we're very careful, they have to be covered, whatever it is. But ultimately, Mishnah Berurah says, it's a basic principle in halacha which we use many times to allow things. After the fact, if the two things touched, if they're cold, good. If they're hot, was there moisture? And if you're in a situation of a shayla, pay attention. You notice two things touch, was there moisture? The assumption by a trivet, where the fire, open fire, is burning, the assumption is that you have a metal trivet, think of it like a pot. And you have a pot on top of it. Think of the pot like a pot. You have a pot touching a pot. No moisture. No moisture, no transfer. Old Chinese proverb. If so, the trivet never became milchik, never became fleshik. Last line of his quote, V'gam yesh litlos, you can also assume, sha'afim nishbach, even if it did spill, kivar nisraf, it would have burnt right away. Kevan shabachos shal yalo esh. The trivet is always on the fire. So, right, I mean, we use the word trivet, it's a little unfair, because we use the word trivet, we're using it on something off the fire. So yes, something off the fire is not going to have the fire burning it and kashering it and drying it instantly. And therefore it would seem that if trivets get spilled on, they very well might be milchik and fleshik. But the stovetop grate, which has the open fire, Mishnah Berurah says it's like unlikely that it's truly chametz. It's unlikely that it's truly milchik or fleshik. Now, the unlikely is very good for us to pay attention to, because that means that if you do indeed have a situation where it overflowed and made a mess,
So then, yes, it may be that the, that it's milchik. It could be it's fleishik. But under normal circumstances, the way we do, back and forth, relatively clean, as far as the trivet goes,
you're allowed to do that. You want to be machmir, you could let the fire preheat for a few moments before you do anything, just to make sure it's clean. Same concept as by the oven if you're going with the lenient approach. Just let it go a little bit so that you know it's clean. The area between the grates, though, is thought of as treif, is thought of as milchik fleishik splatter area, and that's handled however it's handled. If something were to fall there, you have to know how to define it, if it's possible to continue using it or not. If it's significant to you, we recommend a shayla. If you're pulling out a roast that was in a pot and a pan and it slipped and ended up on that middle area, ask a shayla. And part of your shayla, you're going to want to be able to convey whether it was relatively clean or not. Our second section. Drinking glasses, leftover bread, and leftover salt. So this gets a little bit interesting as to how far we're going to take this. And the caution. Yiyu zehirim shelo lishtos mikli echad. You have to be careful that a person eating fleishik and a person eating milchik should not drink from the same glass. Mishum shamaychol nidvak bekli, because the assumption is that some food residue is going to be on the glass and the next person who drinks is going to be drinking from the other type. Kol shekin shelo yochlu mipas echos, certainly they should not eat from the same loaf of bread. Now, it's a little bit hard to know exactly how far to take this, because when they described eating from one loaf of bread, they were not being as careful as many of us are. And correctly so, if you're careful and you're keeping it separate, at a certain point, it's going to remain paruv. But you have to know how careful you were. I can tell you in many homes that any piece of bread that was already cut and that someone who's taking bread would have touched it, possibly with greasy hands, so those cut pieces might very well be considered included in the fleishik milchik realm, whereas the general loaf, if it was kept reasonably separate, and no one was passing lasagna right over it and dripping, if it was kept reasonably safe, then that loaf of bread can be considered paruv. So it really depends on how, I mean, they could very well have been taking their hands, according to the society and the culture, and doing a pull-away challah type of thing, rather than cutting it carefully with a paruv of a knife. But in any case, there's a principle here that something that was left in unguarded territory, and we're not quite sure if it has residue, it certainly wasn't cooked with milk, it wasn't cooked with meat, but it was in uncharted territory, it's already going to be included because it was handled in that way. Question?
What about, and we're talking about Ashkenazi, saying that it's cleaned well between meals?
So, I'm not sure why you identified it as Sfardim. I'm not so familiar. Theoretically, there are many Ashkenazim that paskin like that as well, that a glass intrinsically doesn't become milchik or fleishik, and the only time we're makbid on glasses is for Pesach, not the kashuv, right? But however it is, the fundamental question is, if you hold that a glass does not become milchik or fleishik, so can you just have one set And the answer is correct. If it was washed well in between, in theory, you have satisfied this concern. But certainly before it's washed, the fact that it's glass doesn't matter. We're talking about residue. We're not talking about absorption. I heard an interesting comment from Reb Chaim Cohn. He says he was once asked about a couple that was becoming observant if it would be okay if they just bought one set of dishes. They'll buy Corel, glass, and like this, they don't have to really get involved with this milchik fleishik thing as far as the glass, whatever, the plates. They have one set, one nice set. They buy service for 40, you know? But one set. He said they can't do it. Why not? What does it say? He said, when we're makariv people, we're not makariv people to save them from sin. This is what he says. We're makariv them to normative Judaism. They should be part of the system. They should be part of Jewish community. And in a Jewish community, there's milchik and there's fleishik. And you can't run your kitchen, you know. I figured out a loophole. I'm different. So, however it plays itself out, but that's true, at least in mess-ups, we're quite lenient when it comes to glass. Corel accidentally was found in the dishwasher with the wrong type, etc. That's correct. Glass is far more lenient, and it's a very good protection. I recommend it, especially when someone's becoming observant. I recommend if they're going to buy a set of dishes, that they buy Corel, so that if they're still making mistakes, they're not going to be trafing things up. They'll be as careful as they can, and that's it. Yeah.
Is that because it's glass coated? Corel?
Corel is glass.
Okay?
Corel, I believe, is glass.
Corel is glass. It's heat tempered. Tempered.
China is earthenware coated with glass, and we handle that totally differently.
Right.
Okay. Let's finish off the quote. V'chei noagim. And we have the custom, liyached kli shel melach l'chol echad b'fnei atzmo. We designate the vessel of salt, each one for its own. Ki lefa'amim tovlim b'melach, because sometimes people dip into the salt. V'nishar shiurei maicha b'melach, and leftovers of the food that you dipped into the salt would remain there. Question is, of course, how does that play out with salt shakers? So some people say, well, salt shaker is all you want, but if you watch the kids or the adults touch the salt a little bit too close, it gets steamed on, it touches. It's a smart thing to have separate salt shakers, one milchik, one fleishik, and, you know, obviously you go to different homes and you'll find in some homes, ketchup bottles marked dairy and meat. And you will ask the proprietor, you will ask the homeowner, what is milchik about ketchup? And they will tell you, lasagna. And if that's true, that's true. And basically this is, you know, all about paying attention. In food preparation and storage, how far do we have to go to keep milchik and fleishik separate? So, what's written in Shulchan Aruch is, Ein manichin kli sheyesh bo kutach etzel kli sheyesh bo melach. Not allowed to keep a dish of dairy dip next to salt. Not even going milchik fleishik. It's just milchik with something that's known to be pariv. Salt can go anywhere. You're not allowed to keep the two together because we're worried that some of that milchik dip will fall on the salt and end up being used with a meat dish. The Ramah says, Dafka im hakelim megulim. We're talking that the vessels are open. If they're closed, there is no such restriction, and that's really up to the homeowner, etc., to know what's smart and what's not. So that's why you'll go into a typical Jewish home, and on the same shelf in the fridge, they may at times have milchik fleishik. On the other hand, you'll go into many homes, and they've designated a milchik shelf, a fleishik shelf, and they don't interchange. And that's partly because of this caution that something shouldn't spill one into the other. Partly that the surface shouldn't have spilled. Depends how you keep your home, how clean it is. You could have residue on the bottom of a pot that if you put the other type of pot and then you put it onto the stovetop, it's not the clean application that we're looking for. But we need to know whether that's required or it's not required. In a communal setting, a shul setting, a hotel setting, they will definitely try to designate, if not shelves, sometimes even fridges, sometimes even kitchens. One milchik, one fleishik, and that's just the way you keep it separate in a communal setting when you're dealing with lots of people, especially in a hotel where many of the workers are not familiar with the laws of kosher. But in a shul setting, keeping it tame, it would well be within reason to designate one fridge or a specific shelf so that when you go to the fridge with all of its tin-covered contents and you can't tell what's in what, that this, by definition, this shelf was milchik, and you're not going to expect to find meatloaf in that place. So you won't put those things into the oven together, whatever. Yeah?
But specifically, like in the case of our shul and our kitchen, so when we have an affair, whether it's a fleishik affair or a milchik affair, it often fills up the entire, usually the second fridge is where like the platters and stuff go. And usually, either whichever one it is, fills up the fridge. So it's, practically, that's doable in this setting.
So it would be reasonable to purposely mark it with signs if you're putting two different things in the same fridge, or purposely to wrap, to cover a shelf, to pay attention. I mean, our shul is different because we're perfectly clean. But you go into shuls, you can see that the shul fridge has not been cleaned in weeks because it's a communal type setting and who's taking charge. Right. So I could well see a policy that's cautious. Mm-hmm. It really depends on responsible kitchen staff deciding, is this a reasonable mode of operation? Mm-hmm. If it is, it is. The halacha is only by an open thing to an open thing. Beyond that, you got to be paying attention and seeing if this is a concern or not. And obviously, in cases of constraint, we're going to be more lenient as we pay attention to make sure that we're not doing anything unreasonable. Okay. Leftovers, tablecloths, and knives. Misha ochal gvino. A person ate cheese. Rotzalecho basar, he wants to eat meat now. Tzarech levarmi ala shulchan shirei pasha achlo magvina. Any bread that was eaten with the cheese has to be removed from the table. As well as the mapa, the tablecloth, has to be changed. And the knife, even if it's clean, and even though it's cold, you can't interchange. And therefore, the last line, Kvar Noagu Kol Yisrael Lios Lamshnei Sakinim, we have two knives, we don't clean and kasher back and forth, and they should be properly marked, Sheyehelo Heker, so that they're obvious which type they are. Yeah?
What about like a bread knife, a challah knife? Can't that be
what's commonly done with a challah knife is that people will consciously keep it pariv. Now, if you didn't do that, so you have to keep track of what is it. How do you wash it? Do you dump it into the fleishig dishes together with the cholent? So at a certain point, that knife is going to become fleishig. At some point, hot water is going to hit the two together, and it's going to become fleishig. But if you want to keep it pariv, it's not hard. You have a pariv sponge. A challah knife doesn't get that dirty. You wipe it clean with a pariv sponge, and you keep it in a pariv drawer. And yes, you could definitely keep your challah knife pariv, universal, and many people will take the challah knife off the fleishik table once they're bringing fleishik to the table. So it's more an issue of paying attention. And once you've learned such a blatant sif in Shulchan Aruch, if you encountered something that doesn't match, you would notice it. Serving separately. Afilu basar chaya v'of, osar la'alos ala shulchan she'ochal alav gevina. When we're serving, you're not allowed to serve on the same table milchiks and fleishiks at the same time. So even though each person says, I'm eating mine, there must be a demarcation to make sure that one doesn't lean over and take the other type. Now, for example, in a shul kiddush, it would be unthinkable to be serving milchiks and fleishiks. But we do have the situation of fleishiks and fish. And being that we're very careful not to eat fleishiks and fish together, it requires that it be marked and that it not be some guesswork. In some shul kiddush applications, now I didn't see it here, but I've seen it, where people start smelling the dish and trying to figure out and argue whether it's a meat dish or a fish dish. It should be marked. It should be clear to people what it is, because again, at the same presentation, you're not allowed to do two things that are not supposed to be eaten together, and our custom is to treat fish the equivalent of a milk and meat type violation. We keep them separate. Finally, the issue of pariv by bread. Ein lashon isa b'cholav. There's a specific halacha. You're not allowed to make milchik bread. Shema yavo la'achla im habasar, because we're worried that milchik bread could be eaten with meat, because bread is the staff of life. It just is universal. And that's a very big issue to be cautious about. I heard years ago that when Star K gave hashkacha on bakeries, any item that was common for the bakers to add dairy to make it a little better, they would send for lab testing. Every year, every 6 months, whatever their concerns were, and it was one of the first hashkachas to do lab tests when necessary if they had a suspicion that something was being tampered with. Today, with dairy allergies, I don't think anybody's going to pull that stunt, but nevertheless, it's something to be aware of. The OU had such a situation where they wanted to give a hashkacha on mini rolls of some sort. It's a famous case, but you're not allowed to give hashkacha on dairy rolls. Unless, and that's this halacha, if you make just a little bit so that it's meant for one meal,
Osheshina tsuras hapas, or you make it in a very unusual looking way. You make the rolls in the shape of a D, for dairy, I guess. Shetehemi keresh elayocha babasar, so that no one will use it with meat. Mutter.
Right? Try, by the way, never to symbolize milchix with an M.
Okay.
We only do that for meat.
We only do that for meat. Okay. Page 6. This side is English, and we'll just move along. Number 1. Taken mostly from my Baltimore shul handbook. One may only use the shul's utensils for cooking in the shul. No utensil from home may be used unless specific permission is obtained. All utensils in the shul should be clearly marked with color coding indicating fleishik milchik parif. Similarly, pot holders and cover over countertops similar to tablecloths should all be clearly marked and used as appropriate. Number 2. All new utensils, metal or glass, have to be toveled before use. Donations, we thank you very much. Some people like to have their own style knife, so they're even willing to donate it. But it does have to be properly toveled and properly marked. Yeah?
Aluminum tips that are disposable as well?
We do not require toveling as a mainstream psak. Disposable aluminum tins do not require toveling. The question comes up, if a person's reusing them repeatedly, meaning they're using them for a use that does not cause them to deteriorate, where does that leave us? And in such a case, a shaila should be asked. Usually there's a good solution, such as slitting the side, making it that it's no longer a keli, and then using it for that use. Usually, either it's the type of use that it deteriorates, like you use it with a chicken, and it deteriorates. Even if you reused it, it would be once. It's just not going to last. Or you're using it for the kind of use that you could reuse it and reuse it and reuse it, and you're putting little cookies on it or something and baking them, and you want to do it again and again and again, hamantashen, which if you slit the side and you make it that it's not a keli, you'll still be able to use it for that type of use. And you don't have to tevel it because it became a keli in your possession when you reaffixed it. Yeah?
What if just covered the aluminum tin with foil?
Doesn't work.
Doesn't work.
It's a favorite question. I pestered my Rebbe once about this, and he said, try pouring the batter into the aluminum foil without the keli that's giving it substance. You're obviously using that keli, the outside keli.
But nothing's touching it.
The fact that it's not touching, but you're using it as a keli. It's an interesting question. But I could not find... I wanted it as much as anyone. I couldn't find support for it. Yeah.
Same as parchment paper, if you put it over...
It doesn't help. Yeah, you're still using a keli. The keli is definitely klei seuda. It's an item as much as a cooking apparatus as anything that we require tevila with a bracha.
So
I think at one time we were told you could use up 2 or 3 times before worrying about toiling it. Is that different now?
That's the same concept that we're describing, but I don't think it has to do really...
You still need to slit? You still need to make a slit, you know, say?
I'm having trouble giving a global, because it seems to be very subjective. An example, you were doing hamantashen in the shul as a child activity or an adult activity, yeah? Hamantashen. You want to be able to reuse these disposable cookie trays. You could reuse those trays
in an application of hamantashen, if it's even slightly greased, you could reuse that tray ad infinitum. So exactly why are we not tiveling it? The logic of a disposable item is that it's deteriorating. It's not a keli. Under its normal use, it simply deteriorates. Over here, under its normal use, it's not deteriorating, and I have no intention of throwing it out. I intend to keep using it. So in such an application, we're recommending that you slit the side, fold down, so that it no longer would hold even water. I mean, it just, it won't, it doesn't, I shouldn't say even water, it won't hold any corn. It won't hold. And then you flip it back. It'll still service your hamantashen just fine. But like this, you've made it a keli while you owned it. And therefore it doesn't require tefillah.
Yeah.
But if you tovled it, it doesn't make any difference.
Why would, I mean, you want to tovel it, you could tovel it. I don't know what you do about a bracha. Probably not. But
what if,
it's not required.
If your intent is to throw it away at the end of your baking.
The fact that it's being reused and could be reused so definitively would indicate that you should
okay.
do this trick.
I don't understand exactly what kind of trick. I can't picture what you're slitting, what you're cutting.
The side of the side.
You have a cookie tray.
Yeah.
And the cookie tray not only has a flat bottom, it has sides.
Okay.
There's a lip.
Yeah.
Any one of the four sides, for ease, pick one of the smaller parts of the rectangle, slit the two corners with a sharp scissors,
going down. Uh-huh.
Bend the lip, the side. The minute you've done that, it's no longer a keli.
You said you can then bend it back up again?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In your possession, you bend
it
back
up. Boil it and use it.
Whatever you want.
To give the side more strength back. Yeah.
Whatever. In general, disposable stuff, we don't pay too much attention to. We don't tovel it. I grant you that in certain applications, you know, if you really push your luck, at a certain point, we're going to say, disposable all you want. You're using it as a permanent keli. And at that point, it really would require tevila, and therefore at that point, we should try to find some solution to make it easier for people.
It's not just one use. If you know you're going to throw away after three uses, do you have a problem with that?
The expression is one use. Honestly, the point is that it's deteriorating as we speak.
Yeah.
It's not a keli.
You know,
under normal use, it deteriorates. Okay, we could devote a session for tevila if you want.
I thought there were. I know I've seen some aluminum tins that have a pre-toval that has a whole little
sticker
on the
bottom.
So, in all estimation, they're not pre-tovaled.
Okay.
There's a much easier solution. If a Jewish company makes them, they were never owned by non-Jews, and therefore they don't have to be upgraded for the Jewish kitchen.
So they weren't toveled. They were,
when
they
talk about urns that don't have to be toveled, it's because they figured out that if a Jew owns the company, and however they structure it, it doesn't have to be toveled. Okay? Fish and meat must be cooked in separate kalim during preparation and cooking. That's the policy of this particular shul. That seems to be the policy of the Star K. It is not universally agreed that you can't be lenient, but let's understand what they are saying. When you cook fish, it should be in a fish pot. It should not be in a fleshik pot. But when you're serving the fish, you could serve it on fleshik kalim with fleshik utensils. They're only being careful on the cooking. If you'll take a look at the third question in Star-K's online questions, which I culled a few from, the Star-K writes, is one permitted to cook fish in a clean meat pot or fry fish in a clean meat frying pan? And the answer we're being given is, technically, according to most opinions, you're allowed to do it, even if it's a ben yomo of the fleishik, that the fleishik has been in there in the past 24 hours, but now it's clean. You've washed it clean. However, Star-K policy does not allow its caterers to do so. As far as the cooking goes, cooking of fish has to be done in a fish pot, according to Star-K policy. Again, a practical shayla, you'll ask a shayla, but you'll understand where it's coming from. There are those in the cooking process who are more strict than others about whether it goes in a fleishik pot.
If you kept a pot that's parav and you cooked fish in that pot, could you also then cook other totally parav items like rice or...
A fish pot?
In a fish pot.
Sure.
There's no, and then it could be served. It's not that
the pot the fish pot would truly be parav. That's okay. Fine. Okay? They have an interesting question. Worcestershire sauce. It typically has fish ingredients. Why is it sometimes listed as a fish product and should not be with meat? And sometimes it's simply listed with the regular hashgacha, even though on the back it says it's got fish in it according to the ingredients. And their answer is that if it's batel b'shishim, if it's nullified in 60, they don't require it be treated as a fish product, which is certainly one legitimate approach to that. What cheeses are considered hard cheeses that you have to wait 6 hours after eating those hard cheeses? This is a subject of some debate, but if something is aged and is a hard cheese, Parmesan cheese, if they're truly using Parmesan cheese, would be considered a hard cheese. Many places find that it's too expensive to do that, and instead they substitute mozzarella. So just because on the menu it says one thing doesn't mean they're actually serving you that. But if they did serve that, then Star-K would hold that you have to wait 6 hours afterwards. It hinges on an interesting machlokes that if the cheese was baked, cooked, acted upon, and it's no longer hard, it's at this point melted, does it still have the halachic status of a hard cheese? The OU is a little bit more lenient, but just for convenience and conversation's sake, I took the questions from Star-K, and if the hard cheese is cooked, it does not lose its status as hard cheese. And finally, on the bottom of the page, why is kosher food prepared in two kitchens? I guess that's a question coming from a caterer. And the answer really is that when you're dealing with a facility with lots of staff, then you're going to be more strict. A person in their own kitchen, where they own this place, they could definitely be more lenient. Certainly on the kitchen, but even, you know, like we said, on the burners, on the ovens, on the refrigerator, it's handled totally differently when there's an individual person who's truly in control than when it's dealing with lots of staff that you got to keep track of. Okay, question.
If you use Parmesan cheese as a seasoning, is there an issue with a zayin?